Thanks to the organizers for inviting me. It's really nice to be here. In fact, I know a lot of you would prefer to be out there instead of here. But anyway, it's just gorgeous. So today, since I'm the first speaker, I'll also give a bit of an introduction to this new class of materials called topological crystalline insulators. So we do scanning tunneling microscopy, and so a lot of the work that I'm going to talk about today was done by my postdoc, Ilya Zelkovic. And this work was done actually at my previous institution at Boston College. We had a lot of theory support from Liang Fu and Evelyn, as well as from Arun Bansal and Shin Lin at Northeastern and University of Singapore. Some of the crystals that I'll be measuring on were grown by F.C. Cha's group in Taiwan. Okay, so we've been hearing a lot about topological materials, and the interesting thing that's been developed in the last maybe slightly less than a decade now is that by applying this new perspective, by looking at materials from this new perspective of topology and symmetry, we've been able to suddenly see new phases that we never knew existed before. And here's a short list. These phases exist in one dimension, two dimensions, and three dimensions. And we've heard about all of these things in the last couple of days. And today, actually, I'm going to be talking about 2D Dirac fermions that live on the surfaces of 3D topological insulators. And in fact, I'll be mostly concentrating on a new class of topological materials called topological crystalline insulators. And I'll show you why these materials are very interesting and how you can see very clear signatures of interesting physics in these systems that you might not have seen before in the Z2 topological insulators. The techniques I'll be using are scanning tunneling microscopy, and we'll also be growing thin films on different substrates. Okay, so what are TCIs? Well, this is a new class of topological materials. They were actually predicted to exist by Liang Fu in 2011. And as very soon afterwards, this class of alloys, lead tin selenide or lead tin telluride, was suggested to be belonging to this new class of materials called TCIs. So TCIs are both similar and different from your conventional TIs. Similar to Z2 topological insulators, you have band inversion due to strong spin-orbit coupling. And this band inversion creates symmetry-protected states on the surfaces of these materials. But very different from conventional Z2 TIs, the symmetry that protects the Dirac point is some kind of a crystalline symmetry. In the materials I'll be talking about today, it's mirror symmetry, not time reversal symmetry. Moreover, you can have more than one Dirac cone, you can have an even number of Dirac cones inside the Brillouin zone, as opposed to Z2 TIs, where you expect an odd number. And the Dirac surface states, the orbital character of these states is very important in this system. Okay? So one example, for example, is tin telluride. This is a topological crystalline insulator. Different from Z2 TIs, this has a cubic structure, actually a rock salt structure. It has an alternating arrangement of tin and tellurium atoms. And in fact, this is the three-dimensional Brillouin zone. And in this Brillouin zone, you can see that there are two mirror symmetry planes. So here's one depicted here. Okay, and it is along these mirror symmetry planes that you get topologically protected states. So here's a calculated band structure for the material I showed you earlier. This is the Brillouin zone. And within the Brillouin zone, this is the gamma point. At the edges, close to the edges of the Brillouin zone, close to the X bar and Y bar points, you have these Dirac nodes. Interestingly, because the Dirac nodes are so close to the edge, in the nearby Brillouin zones, you also have neighboring Dirac nodes. And at higher energies, these neighboring Dirac points merge, actually. The cones merge to create a Lipschitz transition. That is a transition between two electron-like Fermi surfaces to one larger electron-like and one smaller hole-like Fermi surface. So associated with this Lipschitz transition is an area in energy where there's high density of states. Okay. Now let's just talk for a second about the role of mirror symmetry. So here's this crystal structure again. So if you didn't take mirror symmetry into account, you would have two Dirac cones at the high symmetry point, like X bar or Y bar. They would intersect in a circle, and without any special symmetry protection, they would get completely gapped out. But if you had a mirror symmetry line like this one, then along this line, these two points are prevented from being gapped out because of the symmetry protection. And this is how these Dirac nodes develop in this system. So here's the Brillouin zone again. Here are the two mirror symmetry lines projected onto the surface. And here are the Dirac points that develop right along these lines. OK, so why are these materials interesting? They're interesting for a variety of reasons. One of the reasons I find them interesting is they're extremely tunable, both by temperature and by composition, in fact, also by strain. So they're tunable by many different parameters. They have a variety of interesting predicted ground states, including unconventional superconductivity. And also, Liang was just telling me, in fact, just like the Z2TIs, under certain circumstances, you can get Majorana fermions in these systems. So I'm going to be telling you about two basic experiments that we did. But before I jump into our recent experiments, I want to give you a sense of how we can show or prove that mirror symmetry is actually responsible for protecting the Dirac node in these systems. So I'm going to take you back a couple of years, show you one of the first experiments we did to prove that mirror symmetry is critical to protecting the Dirac nodes, and then I'll show you how we can tune the properties of these materials, both by composition and by strain. Okay, so in STM, to study these systems, we cleave these crystals in vacuum, and when we do that, we expose the 100 surface. This is what the 100 surface of this material looks like. It has an alternating arrangement of either lead or tin and selenium atoms. Here's an STM topography, and you can see these atoms, the distance between the atoms actually corresponds to one of these two sublattices at lower biases. At a different bias voltage, we can actually image all of the atoms. So here's the DIDV. DIDV in STM is proportional to density of states. Zero is the Fermi energy, okay? So the minimum in the density of states is not centered at zero, like you might think for a superconductor, but it has a general V shape. And you can imagine that this V shape comes from Dirac dispersion, right? So if you have 2D Dirac electrons, then you expect linear dispersion close to the Dirac point, and that's what this V shape comes from. So this is DIDV, this is density of states. Oh, you're wondering whether this is zero.
Yeah.
No, it's not. It's slightly offset from zero. Okay. I mean, we haven't quantified what that offset is, but there's a small offset. Okay. So here's the band structure again. If you look at the band structure, you know, you can take cuts along high symmetry directions. This is gamma x, right? If you take a cut along gamma x, you see the Dirac cone. If you take a cut along the perpendicular direction, this direction, of course, you see a gap. This is the gap. And then you see these two surfaces. Actually, this point corresponds to a high density of states point, which is the Van Hoff singularity. So if I were to compare this with our density of states, then I would associate this Dirac point with the minimum in the density of states, and these two peaks with these two high density of states points, which are the Van Hoff singularities. All right, so now what I need to do is I need to actually understand what the Dirac electrons are doing in the system. And the best way to do that in STM is to use Landau level spectroscopy. So in Landau level spectroscopy, what we do is we turn on a magnetic field and we look at the Landau levels. And the great thing about Landau levels is just by looking at the Landau level spectrum, you can clearly distinguish three different scenarios. You can distinguish massless Dirac fermions from massive Dirac fermions from normal two-dimensional electron gas which has a parabolic dispersion. These scenarios are clearly distinguishable. Massless Dirac fermions have the energy of the Landau levels varies as the square root of the Landau level index. Moreover, there is one Landau level at the Dirac point whose energy doesn't change with magnetic field. With a parabolic band, the energy of the Landau levels varies linearly in the index. That means these are equally spaced, and there is no Landau level whose energy doesn't change with magnetic field. Now, what about massive Dirac fermions? Interestingly, even for the massive case, you have a non-dispersing peak. Okay? The only difference between these two is that this non-dispersing level lies either at the top of this band or the bottom of this band, depending upon the sign of the mass. So using Landau level spectroscopy, we can clearly distinguish massive, massless, and parabolic dispersion. All right. Now let's take this and apply it to our system. So here's the zero field spectrum I showed you before. I turn on a magnetic field. I notice that what I had identified previously as the Dirac point develops a peak right here. And then you have a huge number of other peaks, which are all the other Landau levels. We can plot these peaks as a function of square root NB, which is what we expect in the system since it's a Dirac system. And you can see a few different things. The first thing is close to the Dirac point, all the peaks fall on a straight line, which actually connects the Dirac point. And so this is a highly, if you look at all these peak positions, this must be a very linear curve. You don't have a choice. So this is indeed Dirac dispersion. The second thing you notice is above the Lifshitz transition energy, suddenly the area of the Fermi surface doubles, and this creates a break in the dispersion. You can see that clearly as well. The third thing you notice is that in addition to having the central non-dispersing peak, you have two peaks on either side whose energies also don't change with magnetic field. And the question is, what are these two peaks due to? As it turns out in this system, there's actually a spontaneously broken symmetry which exists only on the surface. Okay? So here's a topography at high energies where you see all the atoms. And if you actually did an analysis of the surface, you would find out that it looks like this. So here's one sublattice. Here's another sublattice. One sublattice has actually moved with respect to the other. So these orange atoms have moved this way. The yellow atoms have moved this way. So there's a relative motion between the two sublattices. And due to this relative motion, mirror symmetry is preserved in this direction, but broken in this direction. Okay? So we have a system where you have mirror symmetry being preserved in one direction, broken along another. And Liang Fu predicted, actually, much before we did our work, in such a scenario, what you expect to see is a pair of cones being gapped out with opposite signs of masses, meaning the mass sign for this cone would be the opposite of the other cone. And also, this would coexist with the massless Dirac fermions. So that explains all the peaks that we see. Essentially, what we find in the system clearly is the coexistence of massless Dirac fermions, signified by this Dirac point, peak at the Dirac point, which coexist with these two peaks, which come from the two signs of oppositely massed gapped Dirac nodes. Okay? So in this system, we can actually prove very clearly from our data that this is indeed a topological material with a Dirac dispersion. And if you break mirror symmetry, you can create a gap. Okay? Now, this was all just background. And now let me show you what happens to the system as you change two things. One is composition, and the other is strain. Any questions before I move forward? Yes?
Yes, I'm just curious. So surface, I quite which way is lead, which way is solidium, but one of them moves in one direction and the other moves in the other.
Yeah.
So that this becomes polar now?
Yes.
Right. So it is polar. And
you mean the charge distribution? You mean because. Yes.
And also that direction can be, there should be four possible directions.
Yes.
Do you see the technical means?
So we haven't found.
Mirror symmetry direction can be.
Absolutely, you're absolutely right. And we haven't, so in our, the largest fields of view that we've looked at, which is about 3,000 angstroms, we haven't found domains. But they must exist, we just haven't found the other domains.
And this polar nature does anything in terms of the spectroscopy?
Not as far as we can tell. In the sense that if you look at this Landau level plot, it's very close to what you would expect to see for the system. Now, you know, we can think a little bit about what it might mean, but I haven't.
But still, plus and minus, you know, there is a, this.
He's saying there's an imbalance,
motion.
Yeah.
Correct. Yeah, that's what I'm asking.
There is, it is a distortion, and there is a charge imbalance just on the surface, but it's not, we haven't.
This symmetry breaking doesn't produce additional feature like a
this
rush
is bar? The, this is the feature it's supposed to produce. It's supposed to gap out the Dirac nodes, and that's what it does. Yeah. Okay, so now let's talk.
You can map the massless region and the partial region, right, in the airspace.
No, they coexist. So
yeah,
if you,
but you know, if you know you fix a specific bias voltage and make real space mapping, you must be able to map. But there is a zero bias.
Is it
done?
Yeah.
So can you say that again?
Yeah. So because there are. You can see two clear peak, right?
Yes.
Zero and
yes.
Some finite energy.
Correct.
So if you tune your bias energy to like a zero bias mode,
yes.
You can map, you know, somehow.
The Dirac point.
Yeah, massless
yes.
Part, right?
So they coexist in real space. These three things coexist in real space.
Yeah, but can you see the airspace distribution of those regions? That's related to some question.
Correct. So we can see the real space variations in the Dirac point, but it's really small. We can talk later. Yes, we can do it. We can park at the energy of the Dirac point, and we can map out the position.
Okay, but yeah. It's really nanoscale or even smaller.
It's all in at the, yeah. There's no way to distinguish these things. They all, at each point, you see all three peaks.
But then actually, I don't understand why you say this kind of surface.
A broken symmetry?
Yeah.
So the broken symmetry.
Coexistence is quite, you know, atomic in scale.
The coexistence is in, at the atomic scale, yes.
Clarify. So one is a structural distortion. That happens over large regions in the field of view. There's only a single domain. The other question is that that the electronic property, the massless and massive Dirac fermion, they coexist in every spatial region.
Yeah.
So the one is about electronic property, the other is about the crystal structure. And the STM experiments correlate.
We can see both, yeah. Okay, now let's talk about what happens if you can tune the chemical composition. Like I said, these are very interesting materials. If you change the tin content, or if you change temperature, you can actually tune this system from a topological to a trivial phase, okay? Which makes it really interesting to track what happens if you were to change the composition. So we are going in this axis now. We're going to tune the tin content from topological to trivial, and let's ask what happens to these Dirac surface states. In particular, we should ask the question, what happens at this critical point where the system is just about to turn trivial, okay? And the one interesting thing here is that, so you can also ask the question, what happens to the mass as you go from the topological to the trivial phase, okay? So let's ask these questions. So actually there has been prior ARPA studies. So from ARPA, as you know, one thing, which is that as you go from the topological to the trivial phase, the two Dirac cones move closer and closer to one another. At the critical composition, they should lie on top of each other, and then they should annihilate each other. Okay, so this is from ARPA. So let's see what happens. So here's the topological phase. This data I just showed you. This is zero field. This is in a magnetic field. You see these three peaks, which represent massless as well as massive Dirac fermions. All right. Here's, as you're going to lower tin concentrations, once again, this is topological. You see the peak at the Dirac point. You see the two mass peaks. But you can already see from here, it looks as though the mass peaks have actually gotten closer to the central Dirac peak. Here's the critical composition. And here you see that you can barely make out a peak at the Dirac point, but you don't see the additional peaks on either side at the critical composition. There are surface states, but that's what you see. And here you've gone to the trivial phase. Now you notice there is no Dirac, there's no peak at the Dirac point. So here's the Dirac point. There's no peak, but there are surface states. Now let me just show you what the dispersion looks like. This is the dispersion for the topological phase. As you go from the topological to the critical phase, you can see this has two cones, this has two cones, this has only one cone, and now in the trivial phase you have surface states, but no Dirac nodes, okay? So this is what we get from our data, that you see a clear progression of what happens to the surface states as a function of tin composition. But we can do more than that. What we wanted to understand is what happens to the mass as a function of composition. And interestingly, if you look at the mass peaks, you find that the size of this gap actually decreases, and at the critical composition, it goes to zero, all right? And the question is, why is that happening? So there are two possible reasons. There are two possible reasons. One is that something's happening to the distortion as a function of tin composition, meaning that distortion is actually getting smaller and smaller, and as you get to the critical composition, for some reason, the distortion actually goes away and the mass goes to zero. But then there are other possible explanations. But let's first look at the first one. And so what we did was we looked at this distortion, the symmetry breaking distortion as a function of composition in our STM data. And here's a plot of the distortion magnitude as a function of tin composition. And you see clearly there's not much change, okay? So then what's going on? Well, we did some X-ray studies and we realized that this distortion doesn't extend to the bulk, so it's a surface distortion. So after a lot of discussions with Liang Fu, this is what we realized. What we see is something quite interesting. So as we know, as we go from the topological to the trivial phase, the gap actually goes to zero and then gets bigger again. So as we go steadily from the topological to the critical point, the gap must go from a finite value to zero. This means that the surface state penetration depth should go to infinity at the critical point, okay? So that means that what's really going on is that the surface states get larger and larger in the z direction as you go from the topological phase to the critical point. That means that the fraction of surface state electrons sampling the surface gets smaller and smaller. And this leads to the effect that we see, meaning the effective mass is given by how many surface state electrons actually see the distortion. And that magnitude gets smaller and smaller as you go towards the critical point. So what we're seeing indirectly is that the surface state penetration actually goes to infinity as you go from the topological to the critical point. Okay. So now that we've looked at the composition dependence, we're ready to look at the effects of strain. Strain is very interesting in condensed matter systems. As you know, we have a lot of different effects of strain. One of my favorite examples is strontium ruthenate, where you can actually increase TC by a factor of 1.4 by straining the samples. You can enhance ferroelectricity, and here in graphene, you can see that this is in the presence of strain, you get these peaks. These are pseudo Landau levels due to a pseudo magnetic field. So in TCIs, Evelyn and Liang predicted that strain can actually have similar effects as in graphene. So it can do a few different things. Strain can actually move the position of the Dirac points in momentum space. And that's the same as giving rise to the same phenomena that gives rise to pseudomagnetic fields. So strain can give you a pseudomagnetic fields, and therefore it can give you Landau levels. Okay? So there are many interesting reasons to study the effect of strain. One thing I just want to mention is no matter what strain does, however it shifts the Dirac points, you can always write the effect of strain as giving rise to some kind of a gauge field. And you can see that as long as the curl of this A, meaning that the shift of the momentum space position is not uniform in real space, you will get a pseudomagnetic field due to strain. Okay, now let's look at the data. What we did was to create strain, we grew thin films of lead telluride, tin telluride on lead selenide. Okay? Now it's been known from literature that by this thin film structure gives rise to a very interesting two-dimensional buckle structure, which is shown here. Look at this length scale. This is 200 angstroms. So these are actually big. It's a two-dimensional buckling on the surface of this material. So what we did was we grew these films inside our chamber and then transferred it to the STM. So this is the image I showed you before. This is what we used as our substrate. And then let's just ask, what do you expect to see when you grow these layers of tin telluride? So here's lead selenide, and let's say I'd start depositing tin telluride atoms. The lattice mismatch between the two is about 3%. So initially, oh, something's wrong. So initially, when you deposit the atoms, the first layer of atoms will conform beautifully and it'll be highly strained. But as you grow more and more layers, you'll get more and more dislocations built into the system. And these dislocations relieve the strain, okay? Until you get to a very thick layer where you have enough of a dislocation density that the DC strain is completely relieved and all you're left with is AC strain. So here's less than a monolayer of tin telluride. You can see there are no dislocations here. This is a very strained system. And then as you grow thicker layers, you get these lines of dislocations. This is how the system relieves strain. And then with more and more thickness, the network of dislocations gets more and more dense. And finally, at 40 monolayers, you get this structure where DC strain has been relieved, but then you have a buckle structure which encodes AC strain. And the AC strain is really interesting for two reasons. One is that this means that if the strain has any effect at all on the Dirac points, it's going to be inhomogeneous in space, which can give rise to pseudomagnetic fields. And the second thing is, we can actually compare the different regions and actually in situ see the effects of compressive, tensile, or uniaxial strain on the Dirac points. So this is what the surface looks like. If you zoom in, you'll see that each of these regions is very well, it has a good lattice. So these are good thin films. And now, let's see. The first thing we need to do is determine strain. So to do this, we go to each point in our topography and ask the question, how much is the atom, how far is the atom from what should be its ideal position? Once you know that, you know strain, okay? So we use an algorithm called the Lawler-Fujita algorithm to detect this. And now let's apply the algorithm to this, this topography, and this is the strain map. Okay, the strain is rather large. It's -2% in the blue regions and +2% in the red regions. Now we're going to use QPI, another technique to look at dispersion, to look at the effects of the strain on the Dirac electrons. Okay, so the way QPI works is you have an incoming wave of electrons or quasiparticles. They scatter off some scattering center, and in regions where they overlap with each other, they cause an interference pattern. The wavelength of the interference pattern gives you direct information on the momentum of the quasiparticles, and the energy is set by the STM voltage. So we know the momentum, and we know the energy, and therefore we know the dispersion. Okay, so now let's use that to look at the DIDV map on this and look at the quasiparticle interference. And to do that, we're going to take a Fourier transform, 1 minute left, of this entire region. So let me just do that. That's going to be tough. Can I have 5 more minutes? Okay, thank you. Okay, so we're going to take a Fourier transform of the DIDV maps as a function of energy, and then we're going to ask the question, what is the effect of strain on the Dirac electrons? So let me do that. This is the Fourier transform of the DIDV map. This is an autocorrelation of the Fermi surface, and basically, if you compare these two, you can see that we can capture many of the features of the autocorrelation of the Fermi surface in our Fourier transform. So I'm going to use this Fourier transform to characterize what happens to the electrons in momentum space as a function of energy. Okay? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to start from an energy close to the Dirac point, here's the Dirac point, and sweep energy and look at these Fourier transforms and ask the question, what happens to the Dirac electrons? Okay, now, so here we go. So you can see that as you change energy in the entire field of view, these Q vectors change in size, and from the magnitude of these Q vectors, you can get the dispersion. So this is the change in the Q vectors. You plot this as a function of energy, and you can get the dispersion. Now, this is for the entire field of view, and what we can do is we can actually go to the strain region, create a mask based on strain, and do selective Fourier transforms of the positively strained regions and the negatively strained regions. So that's what I'm going to do now. I'm going to create a mask and take selective Fourier transforms. So here's a Fourier transform at a particular energy in the red regions, which have tensile strain, and the blue regions, which have compressive strain. And if you compare the two, you can see that these Q vectors, this is smaller than this, this is smaller than this, and so on. In fact, you can see it from the line cuts as well. Okay? Do that as a function of energy, you can see that it's pretty systematic. Okay, so this means that the Q vector, the size of the Q vectors, which is the momentum space, the K, is actually changing in the strain between the compressive strain regions and the tensile strain regions. So there can be two reasons for this. One is that these regions of strain simply shift the Dirac point up and down, okay? This is like a chemical potential shift. So if you did that and you looked at some energy, you would see that the blue regions have a smaller K compared to the red regions. The other possibility is that there's a real momentum space shift of the Dirac nodes, such that in the blue regions, all the k vectors we see are consistently smaller than the red regions. So how can you tell these two scenarios apart? Well, we can tell them apart because we can measure the density of states. And in the former scenario, where there's a potential variation, these two spectra in these two regions would be shifted in energy with respect to each other. So the fact that there's no shift in energy means that the second scenario is true. And what we actually are seeing is due to a momentum space shift of the Dirac nodes. OK, so something's wrong with this. So from our data, we find that compressive strain shifts the Dirac nodes inwards, tensile strain shifts the Dirac nodes outwards, and this is exactly like having a pseudo-magnetic field in the system, and for large enough values of strain, you should actually see pseudo-Landau levels. Okay, I think I've almost run out of time. In fact, I ran out of time a long time ago. So am I supposed to stop and take questions, or? Okay, so let me do that. What I'm going to do is I'm going to say that tensile and compressive strain are not only the only strains we measured. We also measured the effects of uniaxial strain, which is quite interesting. So I'm going to show you that movie, and I'm going to stop. So here's the uniaxial strain movie. For uniaxial strain, you should see that the Dirac nodes actually move out of phase. So that's what this movie is. You can see that these things are moving out of phase. And I'm going to just stop here. Sorry about that. Thanks. Thank you for your time.
Sam.
Yeah, so this last part is very interesting. But I wonder why there is this AC strain. Can you go back to one of these topo, let's say?
I can't use this. I have to use this.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, I think this is good. So for example, like here, right? To me, this looks like blue mesh, one net, and then the rest is red. So I wonder if this is actually dislocation lines, dislocation mesh. And on top of that, you have this red part is a kind of good film part. And if you go thinner one, thinner film, then in fact, I remember seeing this mesh of dislocation.
Yeah.
So I wonder if this is just a high density of dislocation lines.
It is.
They are.
Yeah.
Oh, OK.
So the dislocations form to relieve the strain. And for some reason, the resulting material is not, because of the presence of the dislocations, it's not uniform. It's buckled.
I see.
And the buckling encodes the AC strain.
OK, it makes sense then. OK, good, yes.
How large is that?
200 angstroms approximately.
And, have you estimated how large is the
field? Yeah, it's pretty large. It's pretty large. The magnetic length is a different question. That depends on the. So if you just want the L, it's about, let's say, 100 angstroms for the lowest Landau level. But as you get to the higher Landau levels, obviously the wave function is even bigger. So just for the lowest Landau level, I would say it's approximately 100 angstroms.
Okay, so the magnetic length is comparable to this?
It is. It is. That is a big problem. Yeah. But it's also a question of how steep the variation in the potential is.
So for the Bulkatin telluride,
yes.
As I remember, it has a structure transition.
Yes.
It's a function of temperature.
Yes.
And neither the low temperature nor the high temperature is not an ideal FCC lattice.
So wait a second. This happens as a function of composition.
Right. So the initial part, your first part,
yeah.
I think I understand that you dope, well, it's not a doping. I mean, you put some alloy of the lead telluride and then tin telluride. And by doing so, you move from trivial to topological.
Yeah.
Is there any the structure transition associated with it? Because with ideal FCC, if you do the Venn structure calculation, you don't get the TCI.
Yeah. So the structural transition happens at a different composition. So everything that I showed you is only happening on the surface for the tin doping of lead tin selenide.
Okay.
But there's definitely a structural transition. At the other
end
it's orthorhombic. It's called ortho 62.
Yeah.
It's a completely different crystal structure, and it's not topological.
So in the thin film, did you classify the structure of your film, the second part?
No. We believe that at 40 monolayers, it's probably just a cubic.
Okay. And
The bulk. And we have these surface states, so
now you do have a mirror symmetry because it's a TCI.
Not necessarily. The bulk might have mirror symmetry, but once again on the surface, it's likely that it's broken. But all the measurements we make are far from the Dirac point.
A question. So in the earlier part of the talk, you showed that the symmetry is broken at the surface.
Not all
symmetries, but one of the reflections, so it led to two of the cones being gapped out.
Correct.
Is there some way to restore that symmetry while remaining in the topological band structure in the bulk by doing some, so that you can drive a transition between, no bulk transition. Bulk is always topological, but you're driving a transition between, say, two Dirac cones to four gaps.
I mean, that's a great question. I can't see. So you can try and apply strain,
right?
But the kinds of energies required to imagine how much energy you would need. Mm-hmm. So the reason that the surface does this, I believe, it's because this structure is the lowest energy structure for the surface, mm-hmm. right? Because the surface is a broken symmetry.
Right.
Now, if you want to change that, I don't even know how much energy it would take. Maybe temperature could do it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Other questions? So, Vidya, in the first part of your talk where you showed lambda level spectroscopy, could you have just done QPI without a magnetic field to see all that beautiful electronic structure?
So we can do QPI. The problem with, and we have actually, mm-hmm. and I didn't show it to you. The problem with QPI is in TIs, the problem is because of spin texture close to the Dirac point, you have prohibited backscattering and you have no signal. In TCIs, the problem is you have four Dirac cones, and so you can have scattering in between the Dirac cones, but that signature remains unchanged. It doesn't change until you get to the Lifshitz transition. Meaning in QPI, all you'll see are four dots, and you keep seeing the four dots until you get to the Lifshitz transition, and then you get information, but that's useless because we are interested in the Dirac dispersion.
Okay, if there are no other questions, let's thank Vidya again.